and at the downtown campus. And we hope that you will take part in those, participate in those. They're free to the public, and we welcome everyone to them. We'll hear a little bit more about that at the end of the lecture when Terry Satterfield, who will be thanking Dr. Ostrom, will talk a little bit about Research Awareness Week and some of the other kinds of lectures that you could come to. So for the moment, may I introduce Dr. Eleanor Ostrom.
Well, thank you very, very much for inviting me. I'm a Westerner by birth, a summer Canadian, and I am very thrilled to be here. And enjoy your beautiful cherry trees, the ocean, colleagues, friends. And really, Vincent and I did not bring the snow. So thank you very, very much. I'm going to discuss a series of topics related to governing commons. And starting with local, going on to national. Let us just first ask whether the tragedy of the commons is inevitable. Many of us have been brought up on Hardin's 1968 science article, where he presented the tragedy of the commons. For many policy analysts, the answer to that question is usually no, but contingent on their policy prescription being adopted. That preferred best way varies from government ownership to private property with community property and a variety of other forms in between. In the main, simple solutions are posed for complex problems. And this will be the first of five lectures, all of which will have the theme beyond panaceas and quick fixes, in that I have the sense that right now we have a plethora of very simple solutions being proposed to problems that are far from simple. And I want us to think a little more deeply about the kinds of problems we really should be, types of solutions we should be adopting. Ecological diversity is something that many of us feel strongly about as being a good. There is considerable interest in preserving it as one of the forms of global commons. On the other hand, frequently, the way of preserving it has been to eliminate a lot of institutional diversity in terms of various kinds of indigenous local institutions. And I would argue that we need very serious attention to the problem of understanding institutional diversity and then building on that understanding rather than presuming there is a single one best way. I would argue that at the current time there is a large gap between policy recommendations and our empirical research. So one of the basic recommendations has to do with appropriators. I use that term for fishermen, grazers, irrigators, farmers, users of the radio spectrum, those of us who send smoke into the air, etc. All of us are appropriating a resource, and that is the general technical term I use for users or harvesters. The perception is that appropriators are trapped. In tragic overuse, and thus, whatever the solution is, that it must come from outside. And that's based on a series of assumptions The first one is one I was born, not born into, but certainly bred into in college and graduate school with the amount of economics I have taken. A narrow model of the individual, which is useful for many purposes, and one that I will urge us not to toss out. It's very useful for many purposes, but when it's applied as a general theory, it leads to a presumption that all appropriators are norm-free, short-term maximizers of selfish gains. In the same theories, government officials are assumed to be people maximizing the public interest. Do they have different genes? How come individuals are narrow and selfish, and government officials seek out the private interest? Well, we need to be thinking about how we got to these two conclusions. Secondly, there is a shared belief that it's feasible to design optimal, and I stress optimal, rules by modeling and analysis. And again, I do a lot of modeling. I think models are useful. I'm doing right now both some game theoretic models and agent-based models, but I do not ever claim that I can get to optimality for a complex system through modeling. And the third assumption that is frequently made is that to be organized, you have to have central direction. So these three underlie a good deal of our current policy thinking, and I will argue that all three are incorrect, that all three are a poor foundation for public policy, and then coping with the commons is being used as an example of this kind of problem. Okay, let's talk about the commons. I'll use the term common pool resource. Common pool resources are resources that generate limited amounts of resource units. Now, those resource units could be fish, mushrooms, timber, water, a whole variety of resource units that have an upper limit. Thus, one person's use subtracts from the corpus, the stock. Thus, subtractibility is a very core concept to defining what I call a common pool resource. And secondly, it is difficult to exclude individuals who might benefit from using a common pool resource. So for those interested in theory of goods, common pool resource is similar to a public good in terms of the problems of excludability and leading to free riding, but it differs from a public good in terms of the subtractibility of the resource unit. A public good like knowledge, if I use Einstein's equations, all of you can use them at the same time. But when I use water, no one else can use the water I have just used. Now, when resource units, water, fish, trees, are highly valued and many actors benefit from using them, appropriations made by one tend to create negative externalities, negative costs that are not taken into account for others. So because of the subtractibility, you can lead to negative externalities from use. And I think we can all agree that an unregulated open access common pool resource that's valued is likely to be used and overused, if not destroyed. So the argument is not if you have no property rights and something's valuable, is it going to be destroyed or not? Of course it isn't. It is going to be destroyed. Open access resources that are highly valued are overused. Now, the problem is when we go to the field, We do find that instead of appropriators being helpless, that many times appropriators have designed their own rules in the field. Many local rule systems work very well. If you go to the Maine lobster fishery, this is a fish, inshore fishery that has evolved over time and is well documented to being highly successful. Farmer-managed irrigation systems in many parts of the world frequently outperform very expensive government systems. In Southern California, there are some ingenious groundwater basin institutions that were designed largely by participants. But it's no panacea. Local systems also can fail. We also have found that government given responsibility for owning large tracts of resources have frequently failed when they've tried to actually implement it. And those of us who have studied in India and Nepal have watched what were places that had a high level of stewardship be overused after government ownership was declared. Further privatization, some of the ITQs and other forms of individual ownership have worked well some places and very well, but not everywhere. Now, when we go to the lab, and many of you will not be familiar with work in the experimental lab, and I'm not going to spend time on it now, but I'm glad to talk about it if people want to know. We take the mathematical structure of a common pool resource and recruit subjects who are paid for the results of their decisions and others, and we can replicate overuse. So when we put people in a lab and we give them a common pool resource problem and they can't talk, no communication, just independent decision making, they overuse it. The theory's right for no communication, no rules. But simply using face-to-face communication, enabling people to talk with one another repeatedly without being able to make third-party commitments, reduces over-harvesting substantially, very substantially. Further, we find subjects willing to pay fees to find someone else. In other words, at their own cost to impose punishment, something our theory has not been able to explain. And when subjects are able to make their own rules about withdrawals and whether or not they will have punishment, and how much, they come to close to optimal operation. They move toward a withdrawal system that is very close to optimal. They rarely need to punish one another, but when they do, they do. So that being able to design their own rules makes an immense difference. Well, we need then a number of things as researchers. We do need for our policy analysis to be assuming boundedly rational individuals rather than individuals with full information. We need to be assuming that humans can learn social rules. I'm not saying that everybody does, but there's a capability that we see to learn social rules. And we need to understand that humans can develop reciprocity as a key norm when they can do so supported by trust and reputation. That you know me, I know you, we've worked together with one another or through others over some time. I trust you to be cooperative, you trust me. Man, if you don't come through, I'll be mad as anything. And similarly, if I think on you, you'll be mad as anything. That embeds us in a system that's quite different than anonymous, autonomous individuals. And we need to understand how rules are tools. There are artifacts for improving trust and reciprocity. but not when they are just imposed from the outside, without people understanding why, when, and however. So let's then think a little bit about self-governing common pool resources and see if we can learn some lessons from it. And we now have a number of large collections of case studies and large end studies where we are beginning to get some real consensus. And the consensus has to do with what are the attributes of the resource itself and of the appropriators that increases the likelihood that people will organize their own rules. So this is a set of hypotheses about origin of governance. Okay, let's go to the resource itself. First one we call feasible improvement. Usually is the case that you don't find people getting anxious about improvement of a resource if there's no harm at all. There's got to be some. Begins to get your attention. But if it's totally destroyed, it's useless to organize. So there's a curvilinear relationship between resource condition and the stimulus to get organized and get going with something. The second indicator that is associated with successful self-organization has to do with the kind of indicators that people have about the condition of resource. Some resource systems generate rapid feedback about their condition that's unambiguous. Other resources, like groundwater basins, are hard to understand until you can get modern science and rigorous studies. The third attribute of the resource associated with self-organization is some degree of predictability. That doesn't have to be constant. It can be curvilinear, cyclical. But when resource systems approach mathematical chaos, as some multi-species fisheries do, it is gosh darn hard to develop rules that will be able to manage a chaotic mathematical system. Especially if you don't have the scientific knowledge to know what a chaotic mathematical system is. So relative predictability. And the fourth attribute of the resource associated with self-organization is called here spatial extent. Again, saying it's medium size is hard because the size is always related to the technology that we have for observing. So it's relatively easy for people to observe. But if you have radio and you have roads around the periphery of a resource, you might be able to manage that resource and see its conditions much easier than if it is a smaller resource, but no roads, no radios. And one of the aspects of modern times is the development of satellite technology. And there are now resources that used to be impossible for people to understand and see that we now can do so through satellite technology. So this is a relative spatial constraint. Okay, let's turn to the people. The people who are involved, the appropriators, also have attributes that affect whether or not they're motivated to get organized and set up something. First off, we need to have a salient resource. Sometimes people live right next to a resource, they never use it, they never look at it, it isn't valuable to them, they just happen to live near it. Salience is very important in terms of this is something that people are beginning to pay attention to. For many people in the developing world, the resources that we've been studying are part of their mainstay. This is a source of 50-75% of their income. Common understanding. It's pretty hard to come up with a set of rules that will work if you all understand the system differently. having studied groundwater basins at an earlier juncture, before the some of the geologic studies, people literally disagreed on where the boundaries were. And, you know, I'm not in your basin. Yes, you are in my basin. Well, if you are arguing about who's in and who's out, it's hard to come up with a set of rules that helps you manage. So you have to have some common understanding of what the basin or forest or irrigation system is. Discount rate. Appropriators who use a low discount rate see a long time into the future as being relevant are more likely to organize for the future. Not very radical thought. Distribution of interests. This is tricky. There are very few resources where everyone is homogeneous. Everyone is at the head end of an irrigation system? No. There are people at the head end and tail end. There are people who have large land or small land. It's rare to get it perfect, but if there is a substantial difference in the economic interest, and if the people who do have higher economic and political assets are those who are interested in the long-term sustainability of the resource, the likelihood of self-organization is higher than when the powerful say, use it up. And there are settings where powerful people say, use it up, and it is much more difficult for others to organize if the economically and politically powerful want to use it up and go on to the next. Trust. You've heard me talk about trust several times, but one of the key things in the evolution of rules, especially that will cut back on our use, is that I trust others to follow them if we all agree on them. Very important. Autonomy. This is the capacity to make your own rules, and that comes from two different ways. One way that those of us in the North American, at least in the US and Canada, experience, and now more and more in Mexico, we have the right to self-organize. We can create a unit. We have to use procedures and a variety of other things, but we can do it. In many countries, especially those under Roman law, the capacity to self-organize at the local level is not in the legal system, and only those who live in remote places are able to self-organize. They're far enough away from the capital that they exert autonomy even without the legal authority to have autonomy. And another, and this is the last, attribute of individuals that makes a difference is having had prior organizational experience. Individuals in the community who have know-how in terms of what it takes to mobilize people, have good discussions, create rules, get them followed, etc. Okay, that's a fairly long list, but I think you can see how they fit. Went backwards, so sorry about that. Now, the attributes of the resource and of appropriators do affect one another. And what's most important is that they affect the benefits and costs of institutional change. I do have a mathematical model of this. You will be pleased that I'm not going to present that this evening. But for some of you who might want to see a little bit more formal presentation, I can share that with you. But let's do it in words. What we have to think through are how do we get to a situation where the costs of organizing are lower than the benefits for those who are going to be making the key decisions about creating new rules. So costs are higher when the resource is very large or the boundaries are difficult to figure out, as when the resource is unpredictable, when there's no trust or reciprocity, and when people have to learn from ground zero how to do this. So those are part of the factors affecting increasing costs. Benefits are higher when the resource stock and flow are economically valuable, obviously. When people are dependent, they value that much more in their own calculation. And when people have a low discount rate. So in doing analysis, both participants and we as observers need to relate benefits and costs and recognize that if indeed people perceive immediate costs that are very high and higher than their perception of benefits over time, the overuse will continue. Why it is not a panacea just to say is go local, is if people don't see a long-term benefit cost calculus that is weighted toward benefits, they'll not organize. So the tragedy is not automatically overcome. And further, small is not beautiful all by itself. Larger regimes are important. Many of those attributes of the resource and of people are affected by the larger regimes in which individuals find themselves, so the resource is embedded. So larger regimes can do a lot of things. One, they can provide accurate information. So provincial departments of natural resources, the U.S. Geological Survey, other large units are extraordinarily important for their provision of accurate third-person information. They can provide arenas in which participants can engage in discovery, debate, conflict resolution, courts, and they can provide mechanisms for backing up local monitoring and sanctioning. These are really very key. And we do find some successful external interventions, some of which are donor funded, some of which are provincial level, some of which are national level. But all of these do tend to respect the time and place information of local users. They involve locals in the physical design, drawing on their local knowledge in terms of building physical capital. They involve locals in the design of rules and based on culture, social capital. And they frequently do provide funds for purchase of materials that enhance local materials, local resources, but they require the users themselves to contribute time, effort, resources. They don't just buy everybody off. And they take time to develop. And they teach long-term skills rather than short-term fixes. So, are there lessons that we can derive from successful, self-organized, farmer-managed irrigation, community forests, groundwater basins, inshore fisheries here and there? Are any of these transferable to large scale? And I think we can say a modest yes. No, we can't just say, oh, we know it all now. We've got the global commons solved. No. There are lots of challenges of moving up. One, the more you go up to global, large scale commons, more people, higher transaction costs. National governments may get involved and they may either help or hinder. There's no guarantee that international negotiation is going to give you a treaty that's enforceable. One faces substantial cultural diversity. And many lessons can be learned from the diverse way that different people have managed resources when they come together. You can learn from that. But heterogeneous interests can reduce the likelihood of finding shared interests. So there might be a greater challenge to finding the shared. Further, we face the problem that some global commonses are interlinked. If we want to reduce global warming by planting plantations, we reduce biodiversity. And so there are trade-offs in terms of ecological diversity and global warming as goals. It's hard to get them both going at the same time. Further, in terms of global problems, we are facing accelerated changes. Population growth, which, by the way, in some regions has helped people solve problems, more people, better resources, but in other places has different consequences. And technological growth is also a positive sometimes and a negative other times. So much more effective fishing technology has been a negative. And in some places, technology's led to improvements. One of the problems we face when we move up to the global level is that unanimity is required for most international treaties. That's a hard one to get, getting everyone to agree. It increases the probability of strategic holdouts. And while with local commonses, we have all sorts of chances to experiment and learn from the experiments, we have only one globe with which to experiment. It's a lot more dangerous. And so we don't have clear predictions for beating the tragedy at a global level. I think we have some lessons, but we have to be careful. Okay, what do we take out of this? Well, I would say one of the lessons is that not all users do beat the tragedy of the commons. And in many cases, we shouldn't just gloss over problems. We should expect, when we do analysis, that the users themselves will not solve it. We do have a lot to learn. If we have four variables to do with a resource, and all of those were not the simplest variables, and seven to do with appropriators, that's 11 variables, and they operate interactively, subtly. We need really major studies that are large enough in that we can be looking at how these work together. And we need to be paying special attention to how we measure those variables over time so that the growing theoretical consensus is challenged, improved, et cetera, over time. We need to understand how external authorities can enhance or impede the likelihood and performance of self-governing institutions. We need to not do accounting where we look and say, oh, there are three of the attributes of the resource and six of the individual, so we should have it made. It isn't really that kind of thinking. It's how do they affect costs and benefits? And that's a delicate one to do. Is when users cannot communicate, they don't have trust, they can't build it, they don't have rules already, we have to expect the tragedy of the commons to occur. The partially good news is when users can engage in face-to-face discussion, and that may be through representatives or direct, and they do have the autonomy to change some of their own rules, they may be able to organize and beat the tragedy of the commons. But whether they do depends on the attributes of the system themselves and the relevant larger regimes. So I do bring you partially good news. Now, the long-term success of such a self-organized system depends on design principles that they come up with. Since that is a whole book, I will not continue on with that one right now, but some of you will have at least seen some of that in the past. So, we have a challenge ahead. If we think about all of this as a form of the study of collective action, as it applies to the commons, it has improved. If you think about where we were in 68, we had, they're trapped. Now we know they're not trapped. We can start beginning to pull things apart. But given the number and complexity of what we're dealing with, there's a lot to do. So I'm going to charge several of us with future tasks. Researchers, we need to be doing more case studies, in-depth, qualitative, hard work, to understand how these work in complex interaction in the field. We need to be doing better dynamic theoretical analyses in terms of building better over time theories, or better dynamic theories, that's a better way of putting it. We also need to be conducting large N studies where we can't go in and do in-depth case studies, but we need the larger N of observations to be looking at these systems with all these variables. We do need to do experiments. They give us a way of looking at very focused questions that you can't look at in the field. And we need to be studying empirically over time, where we can watch dynamic systems evolve. This is a big challenge, all of these. Policymakers need to be active also. We need to be moving toward the development of legal environments that enable users to take more responsibility instead of taking it away, providing an enabling environment where people can take on more responsibility. The provision of accurate information, that's expensive and needs to be done. We need, at the policy level, fair, low-cost courts and other conflict resolution mechanisms. We need to be thinking of what are some of the programs where users can really get a benefit in relatively soon, as opposed to saying, hold back and 20 years from now you'll be better off. And when we move to global, we need to be searching out ways of finding mutual interests across national boundaries, a real challenge. And resource users also have tasks to do. Creating associations that enable resource users to share within and across is a very important step. Searching for ways of increasing the benefits of working together instead of focusing on conflict, focus on mutual benefits. Finding ways of reducing the costs they face. And then, most important, drawing on their cultural endowments and knowledge of a local resource to find innovative institutions that do fit the local situation. So we can all contribute to this effort. And thank you very much for listening to me this evening, and I'll be glad to open up for questions.
Dr. Ostrom is open to questions period, so I'll point out the questioners and you direct the questions to her, please. Right here.
Very, very tough question, very good question. There's a big difference between inshore fisheries where the predominant fishermen are large international corporations and inshore fisheries where most of the fishers live there. So those of you who study fisheries know a lot more about it than I do. In some cases, one of the major problems has been that there isn't any dependence on that resource, and the discount rate is not low, and so the presumption is you just go on to the next resource and it up. So that's a problem. It is not the case that all resources are dominated. I'm studying irrigation and forestry resources in Nepal, and that's not the case. I've actually studied farmer-managed versus government-managed irrigation systems, and the farmers do better than the government, as it turns out, in that setting. I don't think we can say eliminate all corporations, but it does lead us to recognize that if a corporation is highly mobile and can move anywhere, that at least two of our criteria aren't there.
Am I missing something? Oh, there you are, over there. That's all right. I thought he was pointing right along.
Dr. Austin, can you give us an example of a successful, significant case of common management?
West Basin Water, groundwater.
Could you repeat the question?
Oh, he wanted to know if I could give you a significant example. Successful example. Sherilyn Kulu. It's a Nepal irrigation system of 15,000 farmers. It has been in operation over 100 years. It is organized in five layers so that the largest, the 15,000, are in a river system, and then branches and then sub-branches on down to local for the amount of water that you can take out. You have bought a share and you then vote that share, and your labor contribution is based on that share. So for those of us who study fiscal equivalence, it is one of the clearest cut systems of fiscal equivalence that there is. You vote, you work, and you benefit all on the same proportion. There are many systems like that. This one happens to be very well documented.
Another question? Yes. In the purple sweater.
Dr. Armstrong, in one of your early slides, you showed different alternatives to managing common pool resources. You talked about the self-organizing, the local, you talked about privatization, and you talked about public ownership, national government. And in the case of privatization and self-organization, you said some are successful and some are not. In the case of public ownership, you seem to emphasize that didn't work
you can repeat that question, but can you get to the nub of it?
Do we need to get rid of all of our governments, or how do we get them more responsible? Did that get to the nub? In regard to many local, I am not entirely pessimistic, but pessimistic enough that I don't see it as a panacea, certainly. And our experience in the last 50 years was very much, especially in some developing countries, that the locals were obviously not capable. That was the policy. And thus, you've got to nationalize, that's the only hope. And that really became effectively open access, because you were giving ownership rapidly, or asserting ownership rapidly, to a body that didn't have the officials on the ground, didn't have the resources to monitor, et cetera. And so it became open access. I'm sorry, it's a longer answer. That doesn't mean that governments shouldn't be in the picture, especially as we move larger, and that some locals are governments. So some of the ones that I would cite in North America are either organized in the shadow of the court, or are special districts, or municipalities, or some of our national parks, I think, have been run relatively well. So government agencies running national parks and reserves, not by any manners perfect, but we don't have perfect institutions, and there's a role. Now the problem is, as we move up in scale, and where I want us to have caution, government X act responsibly, and they will. As citizens, as crafters of policy, we need to be recognizing that it is tough to hold representative officials accountable, and that part of our challenge is to monitor, watch, publicize, etc., so that government officials can be held more accountable than our current theories lead us to suspect. So it's a challenge that we need to cope with problems as we move up in scale.
Up there on the first row.
Sure. Can people be educated to understand how resources work, to use less of resources, etc.? There are two forms of education. One, that which occurs in many communities that are rural and are still dependent on resources, and there's education going on all the way from small childhood through maturity of how to husband a resource. Now, the problem is that for many of us, when I went to buy beets in the market the other day, the guy behind the counter asked me what they were. He had never seen beets with the greens on, and he didn't know what this thing was. This kid's working in a supermarket, and he doesn't know beets with beet greens. So we do face a problem of people being dissociated from farming and from fish. You know, they don't know where fish came from, especially when we can make up crab and other things, supposedly. So those of us who are in the education business have a responsibility of trying to educate so that there is a greater understanding of our own, all of our responsibilities, not just their responsibilities.
Are there any other questions? Didn't you have a question, Ralph? Well then, I'm going to ask environmental anthropologist Terry Satterfield to give the thank you this evening.
First and foremost, thank you. Thank you quite simply on behalf of Vancouver Institute, Green College, my home, Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability, and more broadly, the UBC community. And thank you for reminding us that, in particular, as one of your awards says, of your most enduring contributions. Thank you for reminding us that the tragedy of commons can be subverted, at least under some conditions. And thank you in these troubling times for reminding us that reciprocity and trust and face-to-face communication can resist the destructive power of short-term maximization. And thank you, too, for your just legacy of elegant work, combining empirical field work and experimental work for the best of human ecology, for combining the attributes of physical systems and the vicissitudes of human behavior, collective human behavior, I guess. So, and thank you for launching our Research Awareness Week. It's a great start, and if I can just mention a few things about that. The theme this year, appropriately, given the talk just now, is sustainability in all its forms. And there will be symposia and workshops, exhibits, demonstrations throughout the week, many downtown, covering climate change, sustainable food and water systems, and myriad other topics. This week is highlighted in particular by a full day on the Friday, the 14th of March at Robson Square, organized by the Royal Society of Canada on the Kyoto Accord and the development of alternative energy sources. And information on these activities is available at this website down here on my left, www.research.ubc.ca. So thank you again on behalf of us all.